Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. It's good to be back. And we've had another 2 week break, but we're back with some more news and discussion about the industry. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined by my colleague, as ever, Phil Bishop, who handles our online news. Morning, Phil. How are you doing?
Morning, David. I'm pretty well. I am looking for positives where I can find them.
Oh, good. Does that mean you've got some good news for us?
I think so. Ooh. But some bad news as well to start off with, I'm afraid.
Do we want the good news first or the bad news first? Let's have the bad news first, shall we?
Let's get it out of the way.
We know what this is going to be about.
We all know that this virus thing and the lockdown that we've had has had an enormous impact on the construction industry. Although parts of it have been busy, other parts have been furloughed, stuck at home, sites have been shut. Talked last time about how they're reopening again. But the latest news just this morning on the 3rd of June as we talk is that two of our big brickmakers are restructuring, laying off 600 people between them. Mm-hmm. Ibstock laying off 375 people, 15% of its workforce. Forterra, that's what used to be Hanson Brick, 225 job losses expected there. And Forterra is mothballing its the state-of-the-art Bison hollowcore flooring plant it's got in Derbyshire. They only bought that a few years ago from Lang O'Rourke for £20 million. It's a huge, great place. And they're consolidating their operations there. And closing that for the time being. I hope it won't be for too long. Mm. But that's all doom and gloom. And it was only the other day, Waits, the South London-based construction company, announced 300 redundancies planned there. It's 8% of their workforce. And I'm sure these are just a snapshot of what is happening and more of these will come out.
I mean, I haven't heard of any other major contractors, tier one contractors, announcing any layoffs. Have there been any others apart from Waits?
Not that I've heard of, but I think it's inevitable. I think it'll start to happen when the furlough scheme comes to an end imminently, doesn't it? And I think there'll be people who will get the Zoom call or the text message.
It's going to happen.
I don't know whether
it
makes it harder or easier to lay people off remotely from a distance, but it's a messy business.
And the forecast for industry output is pretty dismal as well, isn't it? I mean, we've had a report from the Construction Products Association. They looked at three scenarios, didn't they? Because of course nobody can predict with any great deal of reliability what's going to happen, but I think the best case scenario from the CPA, Construction Products Association, is a 25% fall in output this year and a recovery starting after Christmas, which is perhaps not as bad as you might have expected, but the other two scenarios are far worse. There's the double dip recession, which would be a W-shaped bounce back, if you like, where things would seem to get back to normal fairly quickly this year, only for the virus to have another outbreak in the autumn and throw us into another recession, of course, and that would just delay things. Or a U-shaped recession, which would mean that basically things don't recover as quickly as everybody hopes and that there's going to be a slow recovery starting only next year. So, yeah, rather a dismal outlook, I would have said. And certainly with, I think I said to you earlier that brickmakers always seem to act like the canary in the coal mine. If there's any sign of a recession, one of the first things you hear is that they're mothballing their kilns and that, you know, they basically aren't making any bricks anymore because nobody's building anything. And that appears to be what's happening here, because of course people weren't building anything when the lockdown was first announced. So they do say that they can, you know, get these plants up and running again very quickly, but as everybody will know who's tried to order bricks in a rising market, they're like hen's teeth. You just can't get hold of them.
It always seems to be the way, doesn't it? It's either you know, feast or famine. There'll be, in 2 years' time, we'll be running all the stories that we ran 2 years ago about shortages, material yes. shortages, and can't get hold of things.
We have the Brick Development Association on the defensive again, trotting out loads and loads of evidence to show that actually there are loads of bricks out there. But on the ground, you'll find that people are still complaining that they can't get hold of them. And I don't know how easy it is to get a brick factory back up and running to full capacity after you've closed it down, I suppose. It's more complicated than simply turning the gas back on and feeding a bit of clay into the production process. There's probably more to it than that.
We spoke about this a few weeks ago, didn't we? It certainly takes a few weeks to, once you press the button, to actually start having bricks coming out at the other end.
Yeah, quite. So that's a bit dismal. Is that all the bad news we've got? Can we move on to the good news yet?
Well, we have hope. We have a plan we've been given.
Oh, yeah.
Roadmap to Recovery, an industry recovery plan for the UK construction sector, has been published by the Construction Leadership Council. Construction Leadership Council, we've mentioned a lot during this COVID-19 episode. They've been effectively leading the industry, coordinating industry response and reaction to what's been going on. And they've got this plan. I mean, it's fairly vague at this stage, it seems to me, but they've got these three snappy headings of restart, reset and reinvent, which is near, medium and longer term action plan or strategy plan. Restart is a next 3 months. Talk about increasing output, maximising employment and minimising disruption, which basically means getting back on site with the new operating procedures in place. And we don't even know. There seems to be an assumption that the new operating procedures are going to last forever.
I'm sure that
cannot be the case, but
no.
That seems to be what the assumption, the working assumption is at the moment. Then we've got the reset for the 3 to 12 month period. Which they talk about driving demand, increasing productivity and strengthening capability. And then reinvent, which is looking forward 2 months, which is transforming the industry, delivering better value, collaboration and partnership.
Mm.
And if you flesh it out a little bit, the thing that struck me as interesting from the restart measures, and we already know that they move the foot to extend working hours on site. They'll be able to work 6 days a week till 9 o'clock at night or something, where local authorities agree, and the local authorities are being encouraged to let that happen. But the Construction Leadership Council is also recommending a construction-specific test, track and trace service for construction workers. Good luck with that. I'm not, going by what I've seen from what Matt Hancock's trying to do, I'm sceptical how well that's going to work, but hey.
The restart, the first one of the three, contractors are getting back to work, aren't they? I mean, a lot more jobs are starting again and getting restarted. So I suppose that's happening.
It's broadly a statement of where we are.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. The one which I can't help feeling a little cynical about is the reinvent one, because this is...
Pause there. Let's a little bit more on the reset.
Oh, yes, okay.
Essentially, one of the big things is something they've been lobbying for anyway, which is... Do you remember, if we talked about on this podcast, reverse charge VAT proposals, which were supposed to come in last year?
Yes, it's a hot topic.
Last October 2019. And this means that the building contractor won't be able to get the VAT from their customers. The customers will pay VAT straight to the Treasury.
Hmm.
And this is all meant to be a clamp down on
VAT fraud
scams and so on by the Treasury. But the upshot is it has a real impact on the cash flow. It's going to be going, the money that's going to be going through the books of the contractors.
Mm.
Currently, they collect bill plus 20%.
Yeah, and they use that as working capital.
Exactly.
Yeah, which they shouldn't do.
On a quarterly basis, to give the VAT back to the Treasury.
Yeah.
Now, they're not going to be able to do that. They won in the wake of the whole Brexit disruption and everything and lobbying, saying we're not ready for it. They got that delayed until October this year.
Mm-hmm.
So their lobbying's already gotten a 1-year stay of execution. And now they're saying last time it was because of Brexit, now because of coronavirus, they need another year's delay because of the cash flow implications. Not only that, something like 40% of builders have never even heard of reverse charge of VAT, and the awareness of it is, I suspect it's because most building firms are small companies who farm out to have an accountant or a bookkeeper somewhere who handles all of that,
yeah.
And it's not their business, and they don't worry about what's going on in that side of things because they pay people to worry about that for them.
Yeah.
But the awareness is still shockingly low of it, on it. So the Construction Leadership Council is pushing for a delay on that. And given that the Construction Leadership Council is not just, it's not like a Construction Industry Trade Association, it's a panel of handpicked industry bigwigs that sit in a room with a government minister, representatives from the Department of Business and Enterprise, and I don't know if the Ministry of Housing are on there as well, but there are civil servants and government representatives on this body as well. So when they speak, there's an element of government voice talking. So may well be, and the construction minister in the Department of Business has already said that they're fully supportive of this plan. So it sounds like we might expect another year's delay to reverse charge VAT.
Do you think it'll get just kicked into the long grass? Is there any chance that it might go away completely?
Well, I'm sure there'll be another crisis along in a year's time to justify another
year's delay. Yeah.
Do you know what? I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if it gets rethought, and it'll keep coming back in different guys.
I think it is deeply unpopular, isn't it?
Change always is, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Oh, the other thing under reset they're pushing for, which is also already happening, is acceleration of the cladding, all that bad cladding.
Yes, the ACM
we've discovered that shouldn't have been put up in the first place, and they want to push forward on that. And all the public infrastructure projects which planned, they want the pipeline to be continually updated, reviewed, and renewed, and get work flowing again. But you were more entertained by the longer term reinvent measures. You were saying.
Yeah, the reinvent. It's basically just pulling out their wish list again for I wish the industry was like this and not the way it is. This goes right back to Latham and Egan over 20 years ago, rethinking construction. Now they want to reinvent construction, but it's the same topics. It's off-site manufacture. It's modernization, the use of more digital technology, and partnering, which is a great idea, and sort of collaboration and less adversarial business practices, fewer adversarial business practices, which are all good things and seem to work quite well in the sort of heady days of the early Blair administration when everything was rosy and the industry was getting very integrated up and vertically integrated. You had a lot of specialist subcontractors working with tier one contractors on early contracting involvement and that kind of thing. There was a lot of partnering going on, and then in about 2008 we had a worldwide recession, and that all went out the window, and we were back to extended payment terms, or rather delayed payment terms, and everybody sort of drew up the drawbridge and put their own house in order. Well, these are good ideas, but we've tried them before and they work for a little while, and then things slowly get back to normal and it's the same old again.
I don't know. I think you might be being a bit harsh. If you look at the A14, it's the A14, isn't it, that links the M11 to the A1?
Yes, that's right. Yes, it does. Yeah.
That opened recently. I mean, I'm quite cynical about the. They say it opened up almost a year ahead of schedule. Part of it did open a year ahead of schedule. Now we can all make schedules a long time in the future and say, "Hurrah, we've beaten the we've beaten the program." Mm. Aside from that, it appears to have been a job well done.
Yes,
absolutely. And that was fully initially it was three separate contracts. I can't remember who the three contracts were. Is it Costain and Balfour Beatty and a third one? I can't remember exactly who they were. But initially, the job was divided into three elements, with three contracts having each. And then fairly soon after that, the Highways England said, no, bugger that, let's all get together and do it all together. Hmm. I don't know whether that was entirely all three teams doing all bits all together, or there's still an element of, of divvying it, you know, the segments of the job up between them.
That's a bit more like horizontal integration rather than vertical integration, though, isn't it?
But it seems to have had the desired effect. I mean, I think, as I say, in spite of my cynicism about deadlines, that we can set them wherever we want. It'll be interesting to see. I'm sure the NAO, National Audit Office, will eventually look at it and report on it.
Yeah.
But I suspect it will come out as a good project.
I think there have been some lasting effects from these attempts to modernise the industry. I mean, we now have ECI contracts, you know, where contractors go in with the client with a
early contractor involvement.
Yeah, early contractor involvement.
Yeah.
And that does work. And they do. You do find that tier one contractors will bring on key subcontractors, especially where they are, you know, if it's foundations or M&E, or depending on the type of project, in order to address problems at the tender stage. And and that, again, I think is fairly standard practice now, and it does work well. So, yeah, these things do work. It's the things like the open book accounting, which I think in times of hardship, people want to play their cards a little bit closer to their chest. And it's not so easy to say, well, you know, I'm entitled to my 25%.
But equally, in times of hardship, or at least in times of change and dynamic, and whether things are moving quickly, open book accounting makes a lot more sense, because in the old days, if there's rabid inflation and the price of steel or materials was shooting up, and the contractor had priced the job expecting, you know, to pay whatever, £10,000 for material X, and ends up having to pay £40,000 for material X, that would be on their own head be it. Now, in a new enlightened spirit of teamwork, if they can, you know, open book account to the client and say, look, we're not claiming any more profit on this job, this is actually what the job now costs.
Yes.
And the old way of doing it used to be, you know, bid low, claim high.
Yeah.
Put in your claims later. And obviously that was, you know, it was a mess, and it was adversarial and caused all sorts of legal arguments and lawyers cleaned up and so on. But I can't help thinking there's an element of throwing out the baby with the bathwater with all this bringing in the contractors in early and getting them to, you know, the design and build we've talked about. As I say, in the old days, the Department of Transport then would bring in a consulting engineer, you know, Halco or Mott MacDonald or whoever, to design a scheme, and then the contractors would put in a bid against the designs that were in front of them. The contractors would then say, well, actually, you know, we could have done it better, or if we could have saved money if they thought of this.
And yes,
it's the build know-how as opposed to the design know-how, taking advantage of that. And so by bringing in your Balfour Beatties in early, and we'll come on to one project which is just about to start next month, where Balfour Beatties were brought in 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And far from bringing costs down, the costs have actually spiraled. But that's not bad for me. Particularly to that job, because costs got hugely on that particular job. You bring in the contractor, and I think you therefore lose the independent oversight that the consulting engineer used to have. The old fashioned resident engineer, or in a building job, the architect. There have been problems. It solved a lot of things, and it's created other problems, which have yet to be addressed. But I feel like I'm a bit of a lone voice in this, because everyone else seems to think design and build is fabulous.
You've brought us onto that Balfour Beatty job.
Yeah, I'll talk about that one. The plan to get things going. One of the plans at a government level is to get all these shovel-ready projects, as the jargon has it, to get them moving. At any one time, the Secretary of State for Transport and other spending ministers will have on their desk bits of paper waiting for them to sign, which will enable construction projects to get going. And they tend to keep these at the bottom of the tray to try and avoid spending money. That's been particularly the case of the belt-tightening years under Cameron and Osborne. It's like, you know, avoid spending money. The projects don't go away. They're still there. They're still in the National Infrastructure Plan. National Infrastructure Plan, remember that?
Yeah.
Anyway, there are all these projects waiting to go. And as part of the... Having seen that house building is shrunk so much, and the 25% fall in construction output this year. I mentioned before it's going to be all up to the public sector infrastructure projects to revive not just the construction industry, but also the economy,
yeah.
At least help revive the UK economy. And among the jobs, getting out of Transport Secretary Grant Shapps' in-tray or his red box and onto site is a £355 million road building job in Hull, the A63 Castle Street improvement scheme, which is essentially putting a city centre road down into an underpass to keep through traffic.
Quite a complicated job, actually, isn't it?
It is quite tricky. Balfour Beatty was brought in August 2014, 6 years ago.
Yeah.
They were handed an early contractor involvement designer build contract. The price back then, I'm just going to look it up.
It was less than 200 million.
Was that right? And it's now a 355
yeah.
million. So
yeah.
It's a significant. And their contract at the time of appointment was a £75 million contract. I asked what their contract is now, and they said it's yet to be determined, but it'll probably be 150 million plus, I'm sure, 200 million for the Balfour Beatty's contract. The good news is that's starting. And one of the big things that added up the cost of that is they had to, there was a cemetery or a burial site of some kind a few years ago. They had to move hundreds of dead bodies and remains. They had to be relocated. So there's an awful lot of complicated and sensitive preparation work for that job, which has happened. But that's just one of several jobs that is coming out of Department of Transport and Highways England at the moment.
Yes, there seems to be a sudden sort of rush of them,
exactly,
doesn't
that.
There?
And I don't know if it's partly feel-good or partly real that things are really happening, but that whole job is actually going to start work next month. Later this year, the M42 Junction 6, which is near the airport in Birmingham, Skanska's has got going on that's a £282 million scheme. Skanska's contract, £143 million. So that's starting later this year, completion 2024. So we've got 4 years of work on the M42 near Birmingham Airport. That's going ahead now. And planning is moving forward with a couple of jobs on the M25. Highways England has put it into the planning inspectorate its application. It's called a development consent order application for a £100 million upgrade of junction 28 in Essex. That's a junction with the A12. That's a John Graham job. And John Graham's also been confirmed as contractor for the A10 intersection,
yeah.
Junction 25 of the M25. So those two jobs are moving forward. And probably more interesting to you, because it helps you connect with the civilised part of the country, is the A303.
Yeah, the Stonehenge Tunnel.
That is still, the development consent order, the planning inspector has finished its work in that, and its report's been with Grant Shapps since February.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he'll announce his decision by July. He said the same thing about the Hull job, actually. He said by July, and he announced that this week. So
yeah.
We could get a decision on that anytime soon. And I don't know how to read it. The fact that he came out with Hull, maybe he's drip-feeding it, and we'll get that as our good news for next week. Or maybe it'll prove to be too controversial and sensitive. I don't know. What they did do, what Highways England did do this week for the Stonehenge Tunnel job is they put out the tender notice for, was it £25 million or £35 million archaeological
yeah.
dig contract, which strikes me as a huge amount of excavation work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
using trowels rather than shovels.
Yeah, and I can't think there's anywhere more interesting in the country
absolutely.
To explore
yeah.
than the world of Stonehenge and Avebury and Salisbury.
And that's the Highways Agency letting that contract, aren't they? It's part of their job, obviously.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. And also, I mean, not Highways Agency, but it was only a couple of months ago, of course, that the Department of Transport gave HS2 notice to proceed. So that's
yeah.
£12 billion worth of civil engineering work released by the Department of Transport. So amid all the doom and gloom of the job losses we started with, there is billions of pounds of public infrastructure work leading the way, being let,
yeah.
Moving forward, planning moving forward, work moving forward, which is good. And of course, the great thing about these jobs is that social distancing is much easier than it is on
yeah,
a,
absolutely.
A city
house building.
Site.
Yes, exactly. I suppose house building is the sector that a lot of people are watching very keenly, because it's infrastructure actually has proved to be fairly resilient during this lockdown. I mean, the government's kept a lot of these projects ticking over, haven't they?
But the a lot of infrastructure is maintenance, all these sort of road maintenance jobs, yes, and railway jobs. And you can do more on the railways because there'd been no trains,
yes,
running.
Precisely.
There's been no one on the trains.
Yeah, yeah. But so, I think house building is far more volatile, isn't it? And you know, private sector and all that. So most of these companies have been furloughing staff. So I don't know, what's the position with house building at the moment? Are they still in the doldrums, or are they getting back to work as well?
They are. They're more and more opening all the time. My understanding, some of the surveys I've read, is more than two-thirds, heading to three-quarters of the sites are now open.
Right.
Whether they're not, I don't think, at full output,
yeah,
capacity. But my impression is that the work is being focused on existing sites which are fairly well advanced, where the sales are happening,
yes,
which can generate revenue in the foreseeable. Whether they are pushing quite so hard on sites where maybe they've just put in the infrastructure and haven't started laying bricks yet, I suspect there'll be some hesitation there,
yeah,
to see what the housing market's going to do.
Yes, exactly.
How the economy as a whole recovers. And it may well be that the speculative housing slows down, I suspect. But
yes,
there's still all the social housing going ahead.
Yeah.
And a lot of the house builders act as contractors on those jobs.
Yes. Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Okay.
We changed track completely.
Let's go back in time. Well, who are we talking about? We're talking about a public figure here, aren't we, largely, which has brought this to light.
I don't know whether you know him as Bobby Grant or Mike Bassett or Jim Royle, probably, but Ricky Tomlinson.
Yeah.
One of he's got to be a national treasure now, hasn't he?
I think so, yeah.
And what younger listeners may not know is that Ricky Tomlinson became, I think Brookside was his first acting job, I think.
Yeah.
Before he found fame and celebrity as a star of screen and cinema, occasional film, he was a construction,
yeah,
worker.
Yeah.
And was one of various people involved in a national construction strike, a national strike of building workers in 1972.
Hmm.
We are probably just old enough to remember, I was at school at the moment and being told, you know, only half the lights were allowed on,
yeah,
and electricity 3-day week.
Well, I've got to confess, I thought that was the miners. I hadn't realised it was a building worker.
Well, no, it's the miners. It's all part of it. It's all the environment of the
1970s. Yes,
and
yes,
it was. Strikes left, right, and centre. I mean,
it
brought down the Heath government, you know, industrial discontent brought down the Conservative government of Ted Heath in 1974.
Hmm.
And it got no better under Wilson and Callaghan. It brought down the winter of discontent, brought down the Labour government in 1979 and brought in Thatcher. So the 70s were a decade of not just glam rock and flared trousers, but of strikes and industrial disputes.
Yeah.
And it was really, really quite bitter at times. And a lot of the bosses' organisations sort of, you know, feared it was a communist conspiracies and all sorts of things. And Ricky Tomlinson, Jim Royle, was one of 24 building workers picketing building sites in Shrewsbury when tempers boiled over and the accusations of it's not quite as bad as what's going on in America at the moment, of course, but it's sort of similar things. You can see how things incidents can
I think they were
escalate.
Charged with conspiracy to intimidate, weren't they? That was a fray and various
a fray and a public disorder type of,
yeah,
threatening behavior with the allegations. But the conspiracy charges were the particularly politically charged ones. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, football hooliganism here. We're talking about conspiracy to ultimately, you know, bring down the government and get the,
yes,
building industry nationalised and that sort of thing. Now, 24 were prosecuted, and six of them, including Ricky Tomlinson, did time. They were sent to jail for, I can't remember how long.
I think Ricky Tomlinson got 2 years.
Yeah, 3 months to 2 years were
right.
Kind of the
yeah.
No, 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years. There was Des Warren, got 3 years. He was one of the okay. I suppose the government would call him a ringleader, but he was one of the leaders of the strike, wasn't he?
But for the context of why they were striking, it wasn't just striking for pay or anything like that. It's to end the lump labour scheme.
Yeah.
None of these people were employed by construction companies directly. They're all just what's called the lump, amorphous, you know, independent jobbing labourers trying to get work where they could, who had next to no rights at all.
No.
I mean, this was when was the Health and Safety at Work Act? The
fact was 1974,
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1974.
So this is two years before the Health and Safety legislation.
I think the trial was actually in 1974. Actually, I think it comes.
Right. Okay. So their real grievance was the appalling site conditions.
Yeah.
And there's a great representation of that actually on a film that Ricky Tomlinson went on to make later in 1991. It's a Ken Loach film, Riff Raff. Have you ever seen it?
Oh.
It's an early Channel 4 film. Robert Carlyle, Hamish Macbeth,
I think I did.
But Riff Raff, and anyone knows Ken Loach's films will understand it's powerful, polemic,
slightly political,
small P though.
Yes. Not party
but
political,
but very grounded in truth. It's set in the 70s, in the time that Ricky Tomlinson experienced himself when he was working there, about the insecurities and the dangers, and the lack of management care essentially for their workers.
It is hard.
Of course, things have changed, but many people would say not enough. There's still room for further change.
Sure.
Anyway, we haven't explained why this is in the news. This 50-year-old.
Oh yes, of course.
Near 50-year-old incident.
Quite forgot about that.
The Shrewsbury pickets have been campaigning ever since for years against their prosecution, and they were saying that actually it was Heath's government lent on the judiciary to quell them, you know, making an example of them, and so on. And adding to the conspiracy theory is the fuel for that is the fact that the government has consistently refused to publish its documents on the case, citing national security. Anytime that's, you know, it's always going to be. And this is also the time of the Economic League, the organisation which Calpine keeps coming up again, and that became the consulting association,
which was persisted until relatively recently.
So this is all the kind of the environment we're talking about. What's happened finally this week? Well, actually, no. March was the first. Eight of the cases were the Criminal Cases Review Commission referred 14 of the Shrewsbury 24 to the Court of Appeal. And Ricky Tomlinson has now been added, him and five others. So another six. So we've now got 14 of the 24 have been referred to the Court of Appeal. Eight were referred in March, and now another six have been added. The six that were added was because they'd given up, actually. They'd packed their bags, said, sod it, we've tried and we've failed. And when the eight who carried on campaigning won their referral, the Criminal Cases Review Commission went to the other eight and said, hey, you know, open door. Do you want to come and walk through it? And
yes.
Okay. So they've now joined in. Not all of the people are still alive, sadly. I mean, all these people are in their 70s. They're all men, all in their 70s or older. Many have died since the incidents in question.
Yeah.
But their cases are being taken by their families and descendants. But this is fascinating. The Criminal Cases Review Commission received these applications back in 2012. Spent 5 years looking at it and said it couldn't overturn anything. It decided not to refer them for appeal. And what's made it change its mind is the fact that they've discovered that some important documents of the time had been hidden and deliberately hidden from the defence briefs. And there's also this big question about the night the jury retired to make their verdict. I assume it was the BBC, ran a documentary
with a wonderful title.
Woodrow Wyatt, who was actually a Labour MP, but he was particularly right wing one, who went on to write for the News of the World column. Was it News of the World column?
Yeah, he was very close to Murdoch, yes.
And interestingly enough, his daughter's very close to Boris Johnson.
Yes, or has been in the past.
Yes,
But it was called Reds Under the Beds, wasn't it?
Reds Under the Beds, yes.
Yeah.
Which showed footage of Ricky Tomlinson and other of the pickets filmed in such a way as to make them look like the aggressor rather than the aggressed.
Yeah.
Whether it's just before they've been hit with a truncheon or just after, I'm not sure. I didn't watch the documentary and I don't recall it.
Mm.
But it clearly was... Under today's legal system, it would not have been allowed to. It would have been prejudicial.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was clearly prejudicial of an outcome of the trial. Presumably,
yeah.
Jurors went home, watched this documentary, and went, oh, guilty of sin. Bang him up.
Would they have been allowed to do that? Wouldn't they have been put in a hotel somewhere? And
I don't know. I'm sure their hotel rooms.
I mean, if not, it's outrageous. TVs.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do find it, if you look back at the way the industry was back in the early 70s, which after all is...
There was a lot to protest about.
Yeah, there was, absolutely. I mean, site welfare was virtually non-existent on a lot of sites. I mean, you know, you'd have a major construction site with maybe a couple of toilets and no drying room or canteen or anything like that. You went and sat in your van or, you know, if you got wet, you just... got wet, basically. You couldn't go and change. I looked at the accident figures. Last year, I think there were 30 fatal accidents in the construction industry affecting both employees and members of the public. In 1973, there were 231. You know, it was such a dangerous industry back then. I mean, it's still a risky industry, and you have
and the
to
workers
watch
had no, barely any rights.
No,
had
none
barely
at all.
Any rights.
And the lump, which you mentioned earlier, which was basically the government. I think there was a change in the tax regulations at some point in the 60s, which allowed employers to take building workers off their books and then re-employ them as self-employed people on the lump. They'd have to get a 714 tax exemption certificate from the government, but then they were back at work as a self-employed person. And the good thing about that was that they paid a lot less tax and national insurance. But the employer was, probably the biggest beneficiary of that situation because they didn't have the cost of employing people. They didn't have to pay for sick pay or holiday or anything like that. And one of the biggest advantages, I suppose, for the construction industry, or rather the contractors, was that if their workforce was largely self-employed, they didn't have any direct employees to speak of, then you wouldn't get union representation there, you wouldn't get collective bargaining, and wages, they couldn't push wages up. Basically, it was a way of fragmenting the workforce and preventing them from negotiating a wage increase. So it was in the interests of the employers to do that as well as the employees. And of course, the Inland Revenue was the one that probably suffered the most in terms of financial benefit. But I mean, bogus self-employment and that kind of thing has been an insoluble problem in the industry ever since, and probably even before
then. Two thoughts occur to me on that. One is from what you've said. In 2020, it sounds like it would invoke the modern slavery legislation. That would come into force if things like that were still going on.
Yeah.
Second thing is, the bosses seem to have got what they wanted, though, because they feared construction labour being organised, so that they would have to pay them more, basically. But that is still the case. Just a few weeks ago, the latest trade union membership statistics came out, and I had a look at them. Construction industry trade union membership is only 12%, which is surprisingly low, I think, compared with 49% among teachers. Now, I always somehow naively thought the trade union movement was a blue-collar movement, was, you know, the people's flag and
yes,
the workers
absolutely,
of the world unite and all that. It always portrays itself as this working class movement. Well, the stats don't bear that out. Employees in professional occupations are much more likely to be trade union members. 4 in 10 people in professional occupations are 40.7%.
Good gracious.
Of employees in professional occupations are members of a trade union. That's in 2019. Overall, trade union membership is only 22.8%.
Huh.
So it's disproportionately the professionals, and where you know you compare it to construction workers, 12%.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
So they've never managed to get themselves organised.
No.
And in London, not specifically construction, but in general, trade unionship membership in London is lower because you've got a more, I suppose, diverse, transient workforce.
Yeah.
It strikes me that there's still massive scope for I mean, we lost UKAT. UKAT merged with, UKAT was the main construction union, Union of Construction and Allied
that
Trade.
That merged with the TGWU, did it?
Unite, it merged with.
Oh, right, okay.
Which, yes, I think Unite itself had previously had the Transport and General Workers Union, which merged with someone else, and they've all merged into these super unions. And the thinking was that the bigger the union, the more their power. But I don't think that the construction union power is particularly any today any greater than it has ever been, although the legislation has moved in their direction and is helpful.
Well, it is this very dramatic stuff, isn't it? This story when you look back at it, I'm surprised actually that I was a teenager when this happened. I mean, I remember the miners' strike because.
We didn't know who Jim Royle, we didn't know who Ricky Tomlinson was then. He was just some scouse labourer who no one cared about.
But there was so much industrial strife back then.
Yes,
I mean,
there were
strikes on every, outside every factory, it seemed.
Well, all the newspapers had Labour correspondents. I don't think a single newspaper's got a Labour correspondent anymore. And I don't mean Labour as in the Labour Party. I mean as in,
No, Labour relations.
Industrial relations.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
I mean, Ricky Tomlinson has remained true to his principles, hasn't he, throughout all this? I mean, he might have made a lot of money and become a celebrity by acting, but I read recently that he's donated well over £1 million to good causes. He might be wealthy himself, but he's not mean, and he still backs a lot of these sort of working class initiatives. And so, I think that's probably why, as you said at the beginning, he should be called a national treasure, because he seems to be a bit like motherhood and apple pie. You can't say anything bad about him, really.
Well, we'll find out. At the end of the year, we're expecting, or at least not before the end of the year, the Court of Appeal, because it's got this big backlog at the moment, will hear the appeals, and the Court of Appeal will decide whether or not to quash the convictions.
Yeah.
But I think every cloud has a silver lining and all that. And if it hadn't been for Ricky Tomlinson being blacklisted by the construction industry, we wouldn't have had Bobby Grant and Mike Bassett, and more importantly, we wouldn't have had Jim Royle.
Indeed, yes.
Well, is that about it for this week, David? Do you think we've
covered quite a broad series of topics, yeah.
We seem to be not meeting so often. We seem to slip down to a fortnightly.
Yeah.
Everything I read says we're meant to be a weekly podcast. What's going on? Is it you being too busy putting the magazine together to spend time with us?
Well, needs must, Phil. It's not that there isn't news out there that we can talk about, but we're all locked down for a start. We can't, this isn't normal. We will return to a weekly podcast as soon as things return to normal. But for the time being, we've got to stick to the fortnightly regime.
Well, that's a shame. But we'll be back in 2 weeks' time on the 17th of June. We hope that you enjoy listening. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, if you would. And subscribe. Tell your friends. Get in touch with us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But for another week, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing. We're currently offering a massive 80% discount on subscriptions to the Construction Index magazine. Order yours online today for only £1 per issue. Visit theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine to subscribe. First issue, the 15th of June.